If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
You're listening to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dira De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of this week in New Zealand and abroad. And it is now the 24th week of the year. We're pretty much halfway through the year. The solstice is next week, middle of winter. It's great to be here with you, William. And how have you been in this past week?
Oh, I've been good. Yep. I'm always pretty good, do I?
We had a little bit of feedback on last week's roundup that I would like to address now. When I say feedback, I meant more a correction of sorts from a foundation member. And Christopher writes in here saying that he's enjoying the interviews with you, the weekly roundups. But he mentions that you said, and I quote, "The treaty settlements are now coming to an end." And I did not correct him. So he's put in a complaint about that, and I'll just quote what he says here. "Putting it kindly, that's wishful thinking. More accurately, it's woefully ignorant. Are you both not aware that due to recent very loose judicial interpretations of the Maritime and Coastal Act, a Pandora's box has been opened for newly defined ongoing Waitangi Tribunal settlements? The courts are now granting to iwi and hapu a restored right to ownership of New Zealand's coast and a few miles of the seabed beyond the high watermark, which is overturning the previous sales of the land to previous governments and non-Maori, a violation of citizen property rights. These claims," he says, "have ballooned to almost 10,000. So when you spoke last week around the Waitangi Tribunal settlements, I guess, what did you mean, and how do we put this in the context of the types of claims that are ballooning out of control and what you may have been referring to?
Yeah, well, the Waitangi Tribunal, is you can divide it up into two types of claims, the historic land claims and the more contemporary claims, many of which are on disagreements with government policy, such as the inquiry that's going on into the prioritisation of English over Maori in the public sector. So I was referring to the historic land claims. And when you look back at those historic land claims, I was looking at information from the Waitangi Tribunal today. They have, of the historic claims that have been lodged, they have settled a majority of them now. And the ones that they have settled constitute 83% of New Zealand's land area. So they have kind of broken the back of the historic land claims. But the man who's written the letter there, he's correct. The foreshore and seabed stuff does open up a whole new vista of potential property claims in the Waitangi Tribunal, and it could go on forever, actually. That's what I was trying to sort of bring attention to. That.
Yeah, and on this show, and like in my, I tend not to want to derail conversations that are ongoing with little nitpicks, some people are going to say, "Well, that's not a little thing, that's a big thing, you should have said something." Because I did think when you said, "Oh, they're Waitangi Tribe, you know, the claims are being wrapped up," I thought you were referring to the land claims, but I had to, at the back of my mind, I had this thought saying, well, the tribunal is basically set up to deal with contemporary issues, as you mentioned, and as we talked about last week, that it has a very strong incentive to keep finding new problems, because the entire point of the tribunal existing and its remit to deal with ongoing issues, like issues that may be these so-called treaty breaches that may be caused in the future, means that everybody who's employed by the tribunal, everyone who's involved in this process, is incentivized as a matter of keeping their job and making money, is incentivized to just keep finding more and more problems and more claims, more and more breaches. It's set up to go on forever. And it's an issue that the coalition government really ought to address. And they have said that they're going to address this, at least in part, in their coalition agreement. So we will keep an eye on that. Unfortunately, there's not much movement on that, as far as I can see from the coalition government.
Well, they have made some public statements, and Shane Jones has made some public statements, and members of the ACT Party have also agreed that there does need to be a sort of review of the scope of the Waitangi Tribunal. So I think they are looking at that, and let's hope that that continues.
And this is a good opportunity to give a bit of an update as well. I think one big item that's had a number of updates from last week has been the investigations that have now been launched into the Māori Party over what went on with the Auckland electorate here, what they did with the stats data and the various allegations that were that the electoral law was breached by treating, basically offering people food to come and vote and to do all sorts of political campaigning that may have been in breach of the Act. So, and then beyond that, the number of allegations on government departments that took, you know, gave deals, gave contracts to John Samahiri's organizations. And of course, he's very heavily, he basically is the Maori Party. He's the president, the big man at the top, the guy who's pulling the strings of all of these different organizations. Could you give us a quick update from your perspective, like what's changed in the last week in terms of this situation?
Well, a number of investigations have been launched. So we knew that Stats New Zealand had hired investigators to investigate what's going on. And in addition to that, we've now got the Privacy Commissioner investigating, and we've also got police have agreed to investigate if there's been electoral breaches. And also Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's announced that the Public Service Commissioner So the number of government departments are reviewing the way they've interacted with the Waipurira Trust, Manurewa Marae, and these other various Maori organisations, and how they've handled their data, whether they've kept the data safe. And the Public Service Commission investigation is going to sort of look across all these different public sector organisations to make sure there's a degree of independence in the reviews that are being undertaken there, and to give the Prime Minister and our elected representatives some sort of indication of whether the public sector as a whole has behaved itself correctly with regard to data and the way they've interacted with these Maori organisations. So my feeling is that the public sector is a bit too keen to be seen to be working together well with Maori organisations, and they're a bit reluctant to be too tough on them for fear of being seen as racist or being called racist. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if they've been a bit too lax in the way they've handled their interactions with these organisations. And there are sort of unconfirmed allegations and rumours circulating on Twitter of things like the Ministry of Social Development, for example, going along and also doing stuff at Manurewa Marae and offer, you know, and getting people to come along and doing treating within sort of days of the election. So they're all working together very closely with these organisations, and I'm not sure all the proper safeguards were in place.
And there's obviously a lot at stake for them because the trust in the institutions themselves by the broader public are being eroded by these allegations, and obviously within the Maori community itself, or these various communities, they basically aren't going to be particularly happy that their interactions with these departments are basically conducted through what will be seen as, I was going to say bribes, but treating is the word that's used here, and the fact that their data is basically just being harvested, which kind of seemed to be an initial reluctance. So it's often said, well, Maori are more reluctant to engage with the government because they don't trust the government because the government's betrayed them and lied to them and let them down. And now it seems like this is being done on steroids, but through Maori service providers. So it's like the middleman, the Maori middleman has been added in to still, you know, do these same things to them. From their perspective, this will be seen as quite a big betrayal potentially, and of course further erosion of participation of from these communities in government plans and government initiatives.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that the government was trying very hard to do some very good non-partisan things, encouraging and improving the census uptake among Maori and encouraging them to come along and get vaccinated. It's debatable whether people think that's a good thing, but...
Yeah, that's it. But, you know, from the perspective of these institutions in particular, they've been trying, like they've been working hard to get people to do the right thing, quote unquote.
But yeah, but because these organizations have mixed up partisan and nonpartisan things, and then they don't have enough separation between the partisan and the nonpartisan operations, and then, yeah, they've just, the allegations at least, they've taken the data and used it for electioneering purposes. And not only that, involved, you know, they're doing this treating type stuff, which is basically a form of bribery. So not good stuff.
And Philip Crump has also basically brought out further allegations this week, saying that the candidate, or the, who's the MP now, to Kuitia Kemp, we'll just call her Miss Kemp from now on, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce her name, the Maori Party candidate and now the MP, was seen at the Marae polling station several times on election day in contravention of electoral laws, and also that party branded clothing was worn by workers at the voting booths. So these are more, you know, big bombshell allegations, in particular around the behavior of this MP. She still hasn't been stood down, or the Maori Party has basically circled the wagons, gone fully defensive on this, saying that they've done nothing wrong, that this is a witch hunt against them. And they've even called on the government to kind of lead an official investigation, which could be seen as a positive thing if they're claiming, well, we want an official investigation by the government. We want the Prime Minister to launch a more official investigation and quash these allegations. But yeah, it seems like almost every single day that we're getting kind of another bomb dropped into the mix.
It's a drip, drip, drip. And it doesn't bode well, actually, given that they've recently declared independence and they're going to set up their own parliament. Now to be being investigated by the so-called Pākehā Parliament. If that investigation finds that things have gone wrong, that's potentially a very divisive situation.
Yes, well, how the tune has changed in just a week and a bit. Now, we've had some movement on government policy this week. Perhaps a key announcement around what farmers or certain farm groups have been lobbying for has been the removal of agriculture from the emissions trading scheme. At least that's been the headline announcement from the coalition government, that agricultural emissions will stay out of the emissions trading scheme. Could you explain this briefly in a simple way for people to understand what that actually means?
Businesses that are inside the scheme have to buy permits, basically, tradable permits for the emissions that their business is calculated to emit into the atmosphere. And so it's sort of like a business cost. There'll be some sort of calculation scheme for a business. You work out how much your carbon emissions are, and you have to buy a permit to be allowed to emit that much. Farmers won't have to do that if they're excluded from the scheme. So many farm inputs will still be included in the scheme. So there'll be, you know, on your diesel, on many of your farm products that you buy, your transport costs, all that stuff will be included in the emissions trading scheme, and it will be a component of the input costs that farmers are paying. So they'll still be included in that way. But basically the rationale for this decision is that New Zealand farmers are already very carbon efficient in comparison to the other farmers overseas. And so forcing them into the ETS will just reduce their production, because they'll have this additional expense of having to buy a permit to emit. And that what that will mean is that the production will decrease in New Zealand and it will increase overseas, with the result that total global emissions will actually increase because of the overseas farmers are less carbon efficient. So that's the ETS part of it. But there's another component to this announcement, which is around something called Hiawaka Ekanoa, which is a separate process that was going on side by side, trying to calculate on-farm emissions and have some sort of pricing scheme for them. And that's also been abolished because it was a sort of a consensus-based initiative, and they couldn't really reach consensus very easily. So the new government's abolished that and set up a new pastoral sector group involving the farming lobby groups and levy organisations to try and figure out a way of taking account of farm carbon emissions. And that's the way they're going to do it moving forward.
So the Green Party, I guess, especially is not happy about this. As you mentioned, the ETS is if implemented in the way that the previous government set it up to be, or rather they adjusted it, I believe, to get farmers included, because the National Party had previously excluded farmers, if I remember this correctly, would effectively result in CO2 emissions increasing around the world. So it's not really about reducing CO2 emissions then, as the for the Green Party. The whole thing, rather, is you think they're basically just openly making it out that, yeah, it's about a tax. It's an extra punishment. It's an extra attack on business. They don't seem to be, you know, what's the angle for the Green Party on this? Why do they want farmers to be included if it's pretty obvious that doing this would result in increased CO2 emissions around the world?
Well, it's really about meeting arbitrarily set and defined targets. New Zealand as a whole meeting sort of arbitrarily set and defined carbon targets that we've sort of agreed to in various international agreements. And in order to meet those targets, they want as many sectors of the economy, including agriculture, to participate in, you know, reducing their carbon emissions as possible. Even if that means global emissions go up, so that, you know, it is a bit silly. It's managing to the target, not to the real outcome.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's all really for the Green Party. It's about the fact that we did our part. That's really what it's about. We did our part. We can say that we did our part, and who cares about, you know? And then we're going to somehow magically force everyone else to do their part, really. Which, you know, putting the whole dispute about whether or not CO2 has any effect on the climate change and whether the globe is getting hotter, putting all of that aside for a moment, it really is the fact that, but yeah, it's just purely about these international agreements, and they want us to be able to say that we did it, we reached the agreements.
I think it's part of the agreements, but it's also, there's a desire from within the Green Party to, they think farmers, among other businesses, are, you know, environmental villains anyway, on a number of reasons, not just the climate, in terms of water quality, also in terms of things like animal welfare. And they're not happy about farmers, full stop. And also the political opposition. Farmers are, in New Zealand, have traditionally been supporters of the Conservative government. And there is a tendency amongst people on the left to try and disempower their political enemies financially and in other ways. So I think part of it is that it's punishing the farmers, trying to take away an industry and a lobby, or weaken an industry and a lobby in a constituency that is opposed to what they want to do.
It's like the Green Party really, at a subconscious level, understands the what's called the friend-enemy distinction from a German philosopher Carl Schmitt, where politics is about rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. And the Green Party seems to be particularly good at that and focused on that. And sometimes on the more conservative side, we kind of, I guess, miss that point, that really that's for a lot of people is the aim of politics. And in actually, maybe that ought to be the aim of politics, in the sense that, you know, we often get these so-called right-wing, center-right conservative governments, and they don't actually really put very much effort into rewarding their voters and doing things for the people who have given them power. So at least a positive thing then, to see that the National Party, and in conjunction with ACT and New Zealand First, is actually delivering for something that a core voter group, a core lobby group that's backing them, actually delivering something that they've campaigned on. So that's a positive in and of itself.
That's right. And there's another announcement this week also related to farming, and that's the announcement of an inquiry into rural banking. Although it's an inquiry into all banking, but with a rural emphasis. So the Commerce Commission is currently doing some work. It's already released a draft report into competition in New Zealand's banking sector. And the government's announced a review to follow on from that. Federated Farmers have been lobbying for a review into rural banking for quite some time now. They've got survey data that says that there's been a sharp uptick in the pressure being applied to New Zealand's farmers by their banks, and they've identified a consistent interest rate differential between farm lending and residential mortgage lending. And there's also some other complaints they have around, for example, the closure of rural bank branches, which makes it harder for rural communities to interact with banks. But a lot of farmers are boomers, I hate to say it, and so the computer banking might not always be as good as the in-person banking. So if you close down the branches, that can have an impact. And the other issue there is a lot of banks now are signing up to and implementing various types of green and sustainability and environmental targets. And the allegation is that the banks have all collectively signed up to these green targets. And it's sort of, if they're all doing it, there's no option to borrow from someone who's not doing it. So it's a form of anti-competitive behavior. So that is potentially another thing that this review will look into. But perhaps the key issue is that the Commerce Commission has identified is the Reserve Bank's capital requirements. So banks are required to keep a certain amount of the loans they loan out on reserve and not lend it out. So it is a safety sort of function. And the thought that the Commerce Commission is putting out there is that perhaps this is stifling competition in the banking sector and creating an unlevel playing field between smaller and larger banks. The Reserve Bank seems to think that these requirements are needed to ensure the safety of the banking system. So we'll see how that plays out. They've had a big week for farming, I think, this week.
Yes, I see it mentioned that I'm working on a coalition tracker. I haven't done this week's update yet, but coalitiontracker.nz. One of the items I'm tracking here is that this banking inquiry is something that they promised they would deliver. So that's something that can be checked off that they're doing this now. And I see as well that it's being run by two committees here, the finance committees and the primary production committee. So they'll be doing this joint inquiry together. And there's not much to be said. I don't know how long these inquiries take and whether or not this is going to be or risks becoming the Labour Party's equivalent of working groups, where set up this committee to investigate this, and then that just goes on forever. So I'm assuming here they have a plan and they're actually going to do something. As you said, this is a key thing that Federated Farmers lobbied for. Again, this is an important political group that's supporting the coalition government. They want to be re-elected once the term is up, and they'll need these voters to support them again. So they'll have to deliver something, I would say.
Yeah, I hope so.
And of course, if they don't, well, then they'll lose. You know, that's what happens to governments. If they don't give their voters a reason to turn up again, then that's it. Then it's over. On the next political issue here, we've had this month's update, but it's the numbers that we get here are usually about a month and a bit behind. So the immigration numbers that we have now available for April, and the updates, you give an update on your Twitter account whenever they come out. So I guess if you want to run with the numbers, the update that you've sort of prepared, and I'll fill in any details and ask any extra questions.
Well, last time I gave this update, we had record numbers of New Zealand citizens leaving, and this month we've broken that record again. So it's there's a gross figure and a net figure, and both are records. So 81,000 approximately New Zealand citizens chose to leave the country. It's about 56,000 net, because a certain number of New Zealand citizens came back. So record numbers of New Zealand citizens leaving, also record numbers of recent migrants leaving the country. So those are the two big groups of people who could possibly leave, and they're both at record levels. Yet nevertheless, the net migration still at 98,500, because we're bringing in such large numbers of people. The gross number of arrivals is 229,000, something like that.
And just to be clear for the listeners here, this is from April to April, so April 2023 to April 2024. all these figures over the space of that year.
Yeah, that's right. I'm giving year-to-year figures. There's also monthly figures, which we could get into as well. But yeah, year-on-year, so the takeaway is huge population churn, near record numbers of people going in and record numbers of people going out.
And this is part of what you call the great replacement update, and something we've discussed. If people are interested, I'll mention it again. The first interview I did with William was on the great replacements. You can find that on RCR, the great replacement discussion on what that means. But basically, as you've said, it's basically as what you're describing here, the deliberate immigration policy to bring in large numbers of people to basically replace either the children that people aren't having or the fact that your citizens are leaving. So you've got large numbers of New Zealanders leaving, and the economic policy, the immigration policy is basically we'll just replace the population and just keep, as we're seeing now, it just keeps going. It just doesn't stop. They keep doing it year after year after year, successive government after successive government. And there's very little talk about it in the mainstream media, very little talk about it from economists, when it's pretty obviously like a massive indicator or has a massive impact on social factors and economic factors in the country.
Yeah, no, I'm not claiming that the policies they're introducing are deliberately designed to have record exodus of New Zealand citizens, but I think they are deliberately designed to bring in record numbers of people. And yeah, as you say, the Great Replacement is just the name for the demographic decline of white people, the reduction in the white proportion of the population that's going on in all Western countries as a result of mass immigration and also lower birth rates.
So you mentioned monthly figures, and I pulled these up because people have asked, saying, okay, well, the National Party made a bit of an announcement. Erica Stanford, Minister of Immigration, in February said she'd be making changes, tightening up visa numbers. I was looking at the raw arrival numbers, the gross figures for about 20,000. Just shy of that, 20,000 for April, and they were 24,000 in February when she made her announcement. So this is like a small decline, but it's hard to tell if the government has actually made changes to visas. I mean, 20,000 people a month is still a very large number of people. As far as I can tell, that would still equal over 240,000 people a year if you have 20,000 people arriving, and that's like 5% of the population of the country every single year. So it's hard, as far as I can tell, there's not been really any change made to just the numbers that we're seeing from the current government, because obviously when we're looking at yearly figures, half of that is still the previous government. I'm seeing no indication that the government's made any particular any impact has been made, but perhaps you've got a slightly different view on that.
No, I think you're probably right. I can't see any impact. The numbers are coming in monthly are still very high. Of course, the numbers going out this month are also very high. But
that's why the net gain, if you look purely at the net gain, it's only 2,200 only, I say. And net gain of 2,200 wouldn't be considered to be massive, right? If you were gaining 2,000 people a month, that's 25,000 people based on these numbers. Of a net gain. That's actually what I remember doing an interview with the economist Michael Riddell a few months ago, and he sort of suggested 20,000 is a reasonable number from an economic perspective of people coming in a year. But the catch here is that the gain, ideally you're not losing 18,000 people a year. It's the same thing. It's 18,000 people a month, which is the largest number of people in one month ever. In terms of those departures, 18,000, 60% were New Zealand citizens. And that is, the largest, just think about it, the largest loss of New Zealand citizens to overseas destinations for a long-term basis. Perhaps people do often come back to New Zealand, but not in numbers like that. The largest loss of citizens in one month. What do you think is going on here with government policy, economic policy? What's causing this massive exodus of New Zealand citizens?
Well, I think the economic conditions, mainly. New Zealand's in a recession now, I believe, or at least a per capita recession.
Yeah. Well, you talked about this last time. They fudged, again, immigration, they're fudging the numbers and saying, oh, we had 0.1% GDP growth. Well, the only reason you had 0.1% GDP growth is because you brought in just like, to 100,000 people, 200,000 people. But yet per capita, we're definitely in a recession, have been for guess, close to a year.
Yeah. To be charitable, there is a chance that, and I think this is probably not true, but there is a chance that some of the departures, the migrant departures, are actually due to tightening up in visas and following up and prodding people to leave. But given that there's such a large number of New Zealand citizens that have also left, they're not leaving because of that reason. So it's they must be leaving because of economic reasons. And so it's likely that the migrant departures are for the same reason. One policy that the government has actually passed, which could be prodding people to leave, is the elimination of the first home deposit subsidy. One of the main reasons, and you look into the data for why people leave the country, is to buy a house and to start a family. And that subsidy was actually something that was of practical use that could have helped people get onto the housing ladder. So I don't think that's the main reason people are leaving. I think the main reason is just the general economic conditions.
We have a little bit of a lag with figures like that as well. Like, I think when they announced that it was going to be stopping right away was last month, which we're kind of just, I think it was last month, was it? Was it in May? And we're only dealing with figures from April in terms of record leaving. So if we see these numbers increase when we get the ones for May, the ones for June and so on, will definitely have an impact. Interestingly, house prices are currently declining slightly. So yeah, it's definitely has been a key reason. But I feel like there's got to be something more going on now, which, yeah, perhaps it's the tightening up of the job market and so on, or just better opportunities overseas, because at least on paper, the housing market is in decline for the first time in a while.
When you bring in a large number of people, that can prod some of the existing people to leave because of the effect it has on demand, not just the house price demand, but for rental properties, rental demand. So people often say, you know, we need to bring in these people to replace the people who are leaving. But often bringing in the people is one of the factors that's prodding people to leave because of the effect it has on the rental market and the job market as well, and things like that.
Sticking around these on the subject of the government and their performance, overall stability, recent polling indicates that the government is perhaps losing a little bit of support. At least primarily the Green Party seems to be polling well. It's hard to know how much you put into polling at this point. I think it maybe gives an interesting indication as to how well people are receiving the government's policies, especially if a government is doing things that are unpopular early on in its term, and then it tries to focus on winning re-election in a re-election year. What do you think of the overall polling situation, which I think all but one poll has basically pointed to the fact that the government, if an election was suddenly held today, the coalition government would still have a majority. I believe that's the situation. But there are indications, especially with Christopher Luxon's favorability, that he may be quite unpopular or getting more unpopular rather than more popular as he's getting into the role.
Yeah, well, there's the one Mikey Sherman poll where she made a big deal out of that one poll result that showed the government might not make it back in, especially because New Zealand First wouldn't have made it back in, and then they couldn't have put together a coalition government. But the rest of the polling suggests that the government would have a smaller majority, but it would still be able to form a government.
And I think it's the negativity, like you think about the immense amount of negativity, constant media barrages, protests that are organized by Greenpeace and so on. Like, there seems to actually be a lot that you would think would be driving down polling numbers with just our wall-to-wall negative coverage, but it's not sticking to the point that I think that they're hoping it is.
Yeah, well, I think you would have to, looking at the polling numbers, I would anticipate that the media's run a concerted campaign to try and paint the new government negatively and destroy any chance it has of a honeymoon period. And in addition to that, there's been quite large protests from the Maori activists. And also last weekend, we saw quite large protests from the Green and environmental activists protesting against the government's fast track bill and protesting against also the announcements that have gone on around mining and the reversal of the offshore oil and gas ban. So I think those are the big headwinds for the government. It's navigating those the race-based Maori protests and the environmental protests. I think the one of the things that might be driving the Greens upwards is Chloe Swarbrick. And she's not popular with me, but I think she is popular with other people. And so if you look at the TPU Curia poll, you see that Labour, I think, is down by 3 and the Greens are up by 3. So it looks like there's a bit of transference of support from Labour to the Greens in that poll. But you're right, Luxon's popularity, that's a big problem. The media often focuses on the sort of the point man, the most popular person, and tries to bring them down. It seems to be the tactic to, you know, direct all your firepower onto the bigger target at the front. And that seems to be having an effect, I think.
One of the things you mentioned in that one negative poll for the coalition, which would have seen New Zealand first out of parliament, it seems unlikely based on other polls. So I actually went back and I looked at what did things look like, you know, 6 months into the Labour New Zealand First coalition in 2017 to 2020 polling. And they actually basically by this point were polling below 5% consistently through to the end, you know, until the election they got out of.
You mean New Zealand First?
New Zealand First, when they were in the Labour coalition. I'm looking at the numbers now, and their numbers are looking pretty healthy compared to where they were sitting at in their Labour Party coalition. So that's something that they may be looking at positively, in that they've learned their lesson, they've managed to create, you know, they seem to be putting in a lot more effort, at least to shore up their base or deliver to some of their donors in a positive way, you know, at least when it comes to mining and so on, and not clearly not when it comes to immigration, as we've discussed. So yeah, hard to tell if that will hold up in the next years, but I could just say to people listening, based, you know, ignore all of the negativity, and if you look at the historic example here, they're doing much better than they were in their previous coalition deal.
Well, that is the pattern for New Zealand First. They spike up in support around election campaigns, and then they fade into obscurity during the term of government. So it's not that's normal for that party.
And is there a bit of a concern that the focus of the government is a little bit off? I mean, I guess the protests that are coming from the left, but you may say cultural issues largely, some of them economic issues, and with New Zealand heading into a recession, is there a risk here that they're not focused enough on the economic side? Or are they, you know, when the tax cuts kick in, everyone's life is going to get better? What are we looking at for the rest of the year? Are things just going to get tougher? Because then that'll get tougher for the government as well. People will blame the government, saying, okay, it's been 6 months, it's been 12 months, and the economy is getting worse.
Yeah, well, I think there is a certain, I think the mainstream New Zealand voter, if we'd have called them that, I think the famous rule of it's the economy, stupid, probably applies for the majority of New Zealanders. And given that we are in a recession now, the fact that the government support is holding up has to be viewed as a positive. And I would anticipate as the economy improves, which hopefully it does improve, and maybe that might take a while, but hopefully by the time of the next election, the economy will improve enough that will bolster the support of those sort of, you know, the Kiwis in the middle. And then you've got the New Zealanders who are more animated by some of the cultural type issues, and election campaigns are normally what fires up those sorts of people. So there is reasons to believe, I think, that even if there is a sort of lull in support for the coalition government, that it might be recoverable by the time of the next election.
And I had one other thought just now, very briefly, was that one of the things that may be helping the government out actually is the Maori Party, basically the race-based issues, where voters are looking at the potential, as they were in the last election, of having, you know, what does a Labour Green Maori Party government look like? Is it, you know, race politics? And it seems to be something, you know, the fear of New Zealand turning into just race politics all the time is very, very real among a lot of voters. So
yeah, Maori Party, a bit of an albatross around the potential, I mean, the coalition of chaos. They've turned around that coalition of chaos term, and they're using it for the National Party, the National Act New Zealand First Coalition. But originally that was the name for the potential Labour Greens Maori Party coalition. And you can see why they would say that with the Maori Party in there, couldn't you?
Yeah. I don't think it's going to stick for the current government. I mean, the things actually look to me quite stable, looking at the issues that they're delivering on, look at how they interact with each other, looking at how their supporters are interacting with each other. I see things are quite stable with the coalition governments. I think that the so-called coalition of chaos simply won't stick on this government. And one final thing then there, I also like to say that I'm hoping that media outlets like Reality Check Radio, like RCR, breaking into the monopoly, breaking the one party, the one media party system, the united front that the media has, that we are making a big difference there as well, and actually providing some kind of balance, actually providing the other side of the story, and that that's going to have a big impact on the New Zealand political landscape in the long term, where you don't have all the journalists basically creating one narrative together and deciding how they're going to shape the country. So that's a very, I'm going to pat us on the back there and say that we're doing our part.
I think so. I think that's right. And not only Reality Check Radio, but just the social media and online ecosystem in general. If you go and look at the surveys that are put out on where people are getting their news, more and more people are getting their news and information online and from non-traditional sources. And different sorts of views other than the mainstream left-wing view are available on those sources, and that can only be helpful.
And we now have about 5 minutes left for international issues, which is a great way to wrap this up. Big one in the past week, and it's rapidly developing, of course, so we'll touch on it as much as we can. But the European Union had elections for the European Parliament, and there were some big wins for right-wing parties, especially in Germany and in France. I believe some of the results, many of them are still provisional or exit poll results. I'm told that the results will be finalized by Monday or Tuesday our time. But it doesn't seem like the people there are expecting a big shift. So we can say that with some confidence, there's been a big shift there towards the right. And the interesting thing is that the younger voters very much are turning to the right. The 16-year-olds have been allowed to vote in European Union elections in Germany, and about 30% but they may simply have done like mock elections in schools. I can't quite remember the details. They may have the same issue still with, like we have in New Zealand with the left arguing that 16-year-olds should be allowed to vote. But anyway, at least the younger people are showing up, at least over 30% supporting like the Alternative for Germany party, supporting Marine Le Pen in France, the National Rally. Big decrease in Green Party support among young people in Europe, and big support for right-wing parties, big support for nationalist parties. Yeah, it's a very different political situation there compared to New Zealand.
Mm. It's largely immigration-driven, but also a backlash against some of the climate change and environmental policies. There's been large farmers' protests over in Europe. I think that explains some of the decrease in the Greens' support. And perhaps the biggest thing that's happened as a result of this is what's happened in France, where French President Emmanuel Macron has called a snap election. And now there's a real possibility of some sort of right-wing government involving Marine Le Pen's National Rally, if she can cobble together enough support on the right, forming a right-wing government that does something about that immigration problem. And what we've heard today is that the French Conservative Party, the party of Charles de Gaulle and Jacques Chirac, has agreed to form an alliance prior to the elections with Marine Le Pen's party. And this is sort of it's an important moment, because they had been pursuing a sort of the gentleman's agreement of trying to exclude the right-wing parties up until this point, that, you know, the so-called far-right parties. And now they've gone against that rule, and they've agreed to do a deal with them. And that may be enough to get them in, or it may not be. It's sort of a borderline. So they'll be scrambling to find enough support.
Yes, many European countries have had these agreements basically to exclude the quote-unquote far right from politics altogether, and they would just form, you know, a national unity governments or whatever's needed to keep them out, or they would just ensure there was absolutely no way that the so-called fringes could not be those vulgar right-wingers, those far-right extremists and so on, the racists, et cetera, the phobes, the Islamophobes, and on it would go. And that, as you've mentioned, has changed, and a number of factors are in play there, which have also caused complaints from the right, is that you see kind of almost a more attempt to moderate a number of positions as well. I believe Marine Le Pen and National Rally have kind of tried to mainstream themselves. But I see that more, I see that as quite positive, because even if they've moderated their policy, the propaganda that's deployed against them is still, well, they're far right, they're extreme, and so on. So it normalizes the fact that someone like Marine Le Pen, like National Rally, can be brought into the mainstream. They can form a coalition or at least a campaign agreements with major, or the old right-wing parties, the old conservative parties that have collapsed in Europe. And then you also see other parties now popping up, like further to the right in that sense. Eric Zemmour in France, I think, is the guy, and his I'm not sure how to pronounce it in French. It's like a Reconquista, but French.
I couldn't help you if that.
You can, right? I'm sorry, my French is terrible. It's one of the subjects I failed at school. But it looks like it may have been, yeah. Anyway, it's sort of, and basically, you've got now National Rally saying, oh, no, those guys are too extreme.
But yeah, Eric Zemmour has agreed today not to stand in the French elections to ensure that he doesn't take support away from the National Rally, so that a government, an anti-immigration government, can be elected and do something about the problem. The other thing to note is that some of the mainstream conservative parties, and even some of the left-wing parties, have actually agreed to, I don't know if moderate is the right word, but they've come over and agreed with some of the so-called far-right positions on immigration, for example. So if you look at Denmark was one of the few countries that didn't have gains for the far-right parties. But the reason for that is because the socialist parties in Denmark have adopted largely the immigration skepticism of the far-right parties. And so the people were willing to go back and vote for the socialist party as they adopted
those policies. I've seen the claims that basically all of Europe, the socialist parties in Europe, could have permanent majorities if they wanted, if they just adopted anti-immigration positions. And they won't do it. For the most part. But yeah, you mentioned Denmark. I'm actually going to try and do some interviews with some guys from Denmark in the next little while. Don't know if it'll happen next week or the week after, but it'll be great to get an update from them on that particular issue, because I've seen that as well, saying, hey, the left is actually able to maintain a lot more ground, and then it's because of their anti-immigration positions they've picked up as well. Now, quickly, in 1 minute, a UK election, have you got any comments, I guess, updates there? I don't believe much has developed in the last week, other than that Reform is continuing to gain in the polls. Nigel Farage is continuing to do well. I haven't spotted anything else that's worth mentioning at this stage. I think the interesting stuff is still a few weeks away.
That's right. The only thing that's really happened there is that someone threw a rock at Nigel Farage. He seems to be, so he's been milkshaked now. He's had a rock thrown at him. That sort of physical violence is only going to help him win his election campaign, I think, or do well in the election campaign anyway.
Yes, it's. I don't see that as a negative for him. And yeah, it's often the case. Violence used against popular or rising political figures tends to really help them a lot. So I actually would expect to be seeing less of that, simply because his opponents will realize that they'll just make him more popular. I do hope he remains safe and that nothing worse happens, because obviously that would be terrible for him. Even if it ends up being good for the country, it would be terrible for him, and we wouldn't want that. And I think we can fit in one last quick international issue, which is the Hunter Biden conviction. It's been announced this week. Again, no sentencing yet. Same with Trump. We're waiting perhaps a few more weeks for sentencing. What's your take on the Hunter Biden conviction? Because they basically had, I think, 170 crimes they could have prosecuted him for, and they didn't. They prosecuted him for something very specific, one or two or three, it was three charges related to lying on applying for a gun license or something, acquiring a gun when he had a prior drug issue, something like that.
Yeah, he didn't declare he had drug problems on the form to apply for his by the gun.
Yeah, so this seems like it's a very, I don't know, there's lots of conspiratorial angles you could take here that may well be justified.
Well, he did. There's lots of other things. You're right. Like,
well, there's 170. So I checked. There was a report that was done, 170 crimes they had identified, and then the department, the attorney general, decided to prosecute just that one particular point out of the 170 crimes.
Under Biden, there's a lot of corruption type allegations. So they've got him on something unrelated to corruption and political corruption, and unrelated to his father. I mean, so just for example, it's just one thing that happened. He was appointed to the board of Burisma, which is a Ukrainian energy firm, and he has no experience in energy at all. So it just seems like a pure, I'm the son of the president, appoint me to the board, you've got access. Well, he wasn't the president at the time, but I'm the son of a politician. Appoint me to the board, and then you've got access through me to a very important political figure in the US. So there's a number of things like that that they haven't mentioned, that shut down to try and, I think, distance Joe Biden, his father, the president, from the allegations. But one interesting thing to me here is that you've got this going on while Trump has been prosecuted. So the system seems to have this interesting way, almost as if it's self-aware that it needs to project itself, project the appearance of neutrality. So it has these, and that's not the only time something like this has happened. This is sort of a pattern that I've picked up where, and when you have one important political figure prosecuted, the system seems to have other things happening on the other side to present the appearance of it being neutral. That's a conspiratorial angle for you anyway.
Well, that's what I was thinking too. And that's to legitimize the conviction of Trump. And they may try, and people are now saying, oh, this, they're definitely going to try and throw him in prison now, because they can say, oh, you can trust the justice system. It's fair. You know, the president's son has been convicted of some crime. And so it's all fair because, you know, even though the crime that Trump supposedly committed was beyond the statute of limitations, and they went and changed the law so they could go back and then they could prosecute some paperwork that he had potentially filed incorrectly, I'm still not entirely sure that anyone understands what actually, you know, what the actual crime was. And then to try and present this as balanced, I don't see it working. So that's why the anti-conspiratorial angle is just that it's unrelated. The system itself is falling apart because people aren't going to bite and say, oh yeah, suddenly I now believe that the legal system is reliable again, because once you start to look at the details, the whole thing, like the idea of balance, completely falls apart as soon as you investigate any of the details in either of these prosecutions.
Well, I mean, it just seems ridiculous that someone so close to America's president is, and a lot of the allegations and the rumors involve Joe Biden himself, things he's done earlier on in his life. It just seems ridiculous that, you know, the president and the president's family could be involved in such sort of corrupt and really not just corrupt, but sort of bizarre activity.
And a lot of it is open evidence for it, right? They had a laptop, Hunter Biden's laptop was leaked. And thankfully, I never saw any of the contents of it, but you see people discuss the contents of it, and quite disturbing things, I won't repeat. But yeah, that, and they seem to, and it's not like they've been, these allegations have been refuted in any way. It's just purely been ignored. The whole situation seems insanely bizarre to me, but that's just how the American system works and how it has worked probably for quite a while. And it seems that, yeah, things have got to a boiling point now. And yeah, there's, the election is going to be very interesting, just to put things mildly. But yeah, there's, it feels like things are getting to a point in America where the system is not able to keep up appearances, and they're at potentially a real point where they're going to have to where something is going to, the wheels are going to come off quite suddenly, and it's hard to predict what can happen then.
Yeah, well, all those conservative arguments that people like me keep making about the importance of the social fabric, we're seeing what happens now when you don't take care of the social fabric. You get very divisive elections, and you get people who don't really want to live in the same country as the other people who are living in the country with them. Your elections become more and more, they resemble more and more a civil war, slowly and surely marching in that direction. So not good developments.
All right, well, with that negativity, we'll call it for today. Thank you very much for joining me again, William, and especially on these international issues. They will simply continue to develop in the next few weeks, and who knows, we may get more positive news as things go on. But that's all we've had time for. Thank you, everyone. Please don't hesitate to text us at 2057 and email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. And that's it for this week's roundup. And if you've got important comments for us, we'll be sure to include them in next week's show. Thank you, William.
Thanks.
And to the listeners, we will be right back after this break.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.